We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft, is at the controls. And we're very pleased to have as our guest in this hour of the show, Michael Isikoff. This summer, he went to work at NBC as a national investigative correspondent. I think a lot of people will continue, however, to associate him with Newsweek magazine, where he was an investigative correspondent, had been working there since June of 1994. He wrote a lot about the war on terror, the Abu Ghraib scandal, campaign finance, congressional ethics abuses, presidential politics, other national issues. He's the author of two books, Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin, Scandal, and the Selling of the Iraq War, which he co-wrote with David Korn, and also an earlier book, Uncovering Clinton, A Reporter's Story, which was about his reporting of the Lewinsky story. He also, before going to work at Newsweek, he worked for the Washington Post. He's going to be on the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk this week. It is a lecture on Torture, A Global History, and this will be taking place on Wednesday, the 15th. It's sponsored by the University of Illinois History Department. It begins at 8 in the evening on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center on the campus. That's 919 West Illinois in Urbana. It is free and open to the public, so anyone who is interested, you are in and around Champaign-Urbana, would like to attend. You should feel welcome to stop by. And also here on the program, questions are welcome. Questions are welcome from anybody who's listening, but we hope if you want to call in that you will indeed make it a question and try to be brief just so we can keep it short and get in as many people as possible in this part of the show. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we have email, so if you'd like to send in your question that way, you can write to will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you want to be a part of the conversation, you should feel welcome to do that. And Mr. Isikoff, hello.
Good afternoon.
Thanks very much
for
talking with us. Just to start out this, I realize this may be a kind of a big question, but I'm interested in having you talk about how well you think that news media here in this country have done in taking on this story, that is the torture story. And I suppose I find myself thinking about the fact that I know that at various points, you know, in various newsrooms, there was a lot of debate about whether they even wanted to use the word.
That's right. And look, it was a tough story to ferret out because the CIA's use of what it called enhanced interrogation techniques was for quite some time one of the most closely held secrets inside the government. It was a highly classified program. The memos that justified it were extremely closely held. Few people were aware of it, so much so that the story sort of dribbled out in dribs and drabs and the press, and it was really driven by press coverage. I think you can go back to the Abu Ghraib scandal in 2004, which really started to sort of breach the cone of silence about this, and those photographs that became public showing the sort of shocking treatment of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, and that led to more media focus on the roots of Abu Ghraib. How did this come about? Where did it come from? And then gradually over the years, people began to talk, documents were leaked, and the press was able to begin to put together the full story. I should add that I don't know that today we have the full story of what's happened. There really hasn't been a full public airing of exactly what was done to high-value detainees captured after September 11th. But we have learned quite a bit, and I do think it's thanks to the news media.
Yeah. Well, just to grab onto that last little piece there that you had there, do you think that the Obama administration is going to push for some kind of inquiry into what the previous administration had done.
No, not at all. The President Obama himself has shut that down. There was a lot of talk of that in the first months of the Obama administration. Some people within the administration were sympathetic to that. Senator Leahy, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, had called for a truth commission. Senator Whitehouse of Rhode Island, who'd been very aggressive on this issue, had issued similar calls, but there was enormous pushback from inside the intelligence community. President Obama sided with his intelligence aides, including CIA Director Leon Panetta, shut down the idea of a truth commission, although there has been a Justice Department inquiry by a special counsel. Little has been heard of that, and I think little is expected from it.
Well, I'm sure that there are reporters continue to work on the story, that there will be people who have pieces of it, and then there may be people who were somehow on the inside one way or another who might decide that they want to, that this information should be made public. Do you think that it is possible, maybe over the next few years, that the story is going to unravel some more, and we will learn more about what happened?
The only way we are likely to learn more at this point, or learn substantially more, is if we finally get trials of some of the high-value detainees and defense lawyers in the course of trying to defend their clients, attempt to put the government on trial and air what was done to them. And in the course of those trials, depending on judicial rulings, either in civilian courts or at military commissions, some of this evidence may be made public. And I think that's really the only avenue at this point to get some kind of airing.
Yeah. Well, you talked about the fact that perhaps that when this first came to public attention, and maybe when news media really started looking at it, was when the Abu Ghraib story broke. So you have to at least go back a few years before that, to the time after 9/11, when the war on terror became as high a priority as it was and is, though then you wonder, well, the kinds of things that we're talking about here, enhanced interrogation, what do we know about what was happening before 9/11? In fact, do we know anything about how people thought about things like this before 9/11, or was it much of an issue before 9/11?
Well, I don't think it was a public issue before 9/11. I mean, the practice of waterboarding, which is a simulated drowning, goes back centuries, really, and had always been regarded as torture. In fact, it was prosecuted as such by torture by the U.S. government in war crimes trials of the Japanese. The practice was used by U.S. military people in the suppression of the Philippines Rebellion after Spanish-American War. But there had been pretty much a consensus over the years that this was torture. In fact, it was criminally prosecuted by the Justice Department when they found instances of people inside the United States, sheriff's deputies, using this kind of interrogation technique. There never was much debate about it. The CIA, after 9/11, developed this as a way to interrogate witnesses, used a portion of it, but tried to argue, tried to construct it based in part on the advice of outside contractors, that it could be done in such a way that it would not constitute torture, and they got legal memos, which have since become public, backing them up on that point.
That's, I guess, the thing that maybe concerns people the most out of all of this. That is, you know, how is it that, given that U.S. law bans torture, international law bans torture, there's a U.N. convention against torture, and the U.S. is a signatory. So then the question becomes, well, who gets to decide what is torture, and how is it that something that had previously been generally agreed to be torture somehow then becomes something else?
Well, a lot of tortured reasoning by lawyers is the quick answer, as we've seen from the publication of Internal Justice Department memos that were written in 2002, 2003, 2004. Lawyers, a small group of lawyers at the Justice Department working with the White House, developed legal rationales that said if done in certain ways that were not intentionally designed to inflict harm upon the person being interrogated, then this could be legal. Now, you look at the, you know, people have read those memos. They've been dissected. There was a Justice Department internal inquiry into those memos by the Office of Professional Responsibility. That inquiry by OPR, as it's called, concluded that the two lawyers who were principally responsible for these memos, one now a federal judge, Jay Bybee, and the other a well-known law professor, John Yu, had violated the professional canons of ethics because those memos were so distorted, so twisted that they could not that they went outside the bounds of proper legal advice. Yet that conclusion was overruled by a senior Justice Department official who said that the standards are too nebulous for this kind of thing, and as a result, there has been no accountability for the construction of those memos. Now, the memos have been revoked; they're no longer. In fact, they have been rescinded even during the Bush administration. This really took place in the first term of George W. Bush. They were rescinded once there became the press got on to the existence of these memos, and there was a public airing of this issue. The memos were rescinded by the Bush administration. They are no longer government policy. But to your question, accountability, there really has been none.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Michael Isikoff. He is a national investigative correspondent for NBC News. For a long time, worked for Newsweek magazine, has written a lot about this issue, about the war on terror, and about torture. He's going to be on the campus of the University of Illinois a little bit later in the week on Wednesday, and he will be talking about torture. This is part of a lecture. This is a lecture sponsored by the U of I History Department. It's part of a series that they're doing looking at torture, and this will be taking place at the Levis Faculty Center on Wednesday, the 15th, 8 in the evening. It's open to the public. Anybody who was interested in attending should feel welcome. Here on the program, questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you may also email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller, Champaign County, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. I think that you were early on the story of the Al-Libi case, if I recollect. This goes to the construction of the case for attacking Iraq. And I guess a realpolitik person would say that torture worked because they got the false story that they wanted to hear from him. So I wanted you to comment on that because people say that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up.
Before I go, I don't always get a follow-up. So can I also ask you if Bybee was on the Ninth Circuit decision and or whether he has to recuse himself. This, you mentioned that the only way stuff is going to get out is if this court case is well standing. National security defense was argued by Holder's Justice Department,
yeah.
And I'd like for you to comment on that as well.
Sure. Well, first of all, on Al-Libi, that actually is one of the more fascinating side stories of this and something I'll be talking about when I am when I speak on Wednesday night. We're talking about a high-level Al-Qaeda, a high-level Al-Qaeda ally, Ibn Sheikh Al-Libi, who was captured by the U.S. military after the original U.S. Invasion of Afghanistan post 9/11. The CIA took custody of Al-Libi. He was rendered to Egypt for interrogations, and then became the source for one of the more notorious claims made by the Bush administration, in the run-up to the Iraq War, specifically that Saddam Hussein's government was supposedly training al-Qaeda operatives in chemical and biological weapons. This claim was made by President Bush in his big speech just before the congressional vote on authorizing the invasion of Iraq in October of 2002. It was repeated in much greater detail by Secretary of State Colin Powell in his famous speech to the Security Council in February 2003, and became a major part of the Bush administration's claim that there was some sort of alliance between Saddam Hussein's government and al-Qaeda. And it all rested on what this one guy, Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, was supposed to have told to his Egyptian interrogators, that he was aware of training of Saddam Hussein's of al-Qaeda operatives by the Iraqis. Now, it later turned out that, number one, al-Libi was, for all intents and purposes, tortured by the Egyptians before he made this claim. In fact, internal CIA cables show that al-Libi, once he was returned to U.S. custody, talked about being beaten up by the Egyptians, thrown into a box for 19, a cramped box for 19 hours. This, for all intents and purposes, was a mock burial to make him think he was being buried alive and would never escape. And it was only after that that he made this claim. Well, guess what? After he's returned to U.S. custody, after he, after this claim has been made by the Bush administration to justify the invasion of Iraq, al-Libi recanted the whole thing, said he simply had made it up to stop the torture that the Egyptians were inflicting upon him during his interrogations, and that the entire story was false. And since the CIA had no other corroboration for this tale, it was forced to withdraw all its internal reports based on claiming that there was some sort of Iraqi training of chemical and biological weapons of al-Qaeda operatives. So this key claim used by the Bush administration to justify the invasion was based on tortured testimony. Now, I think the caller said it showed it worked because the Bush administration's got the information that it wanted to get, or got the claims it wanted to get. I would argue that that actually what the story really shows is how what you get from this kind of interrogation, what you get from torture, is you can get information, but you don't get truthful information. So if the goal is to get accurate, truthful information from an interrogation, then this is the classic case, the premier classic case, I think, in modern times, of how you get false, bogus information that, in effect, torture does not work.
Right. And what about the caller, I think, was asking about the possibility that someone who was a whole involved in the process of defining torture might also be in a position to decide whether or not what kind of information gets released.
Well, Jay Bybee, who is one of those one of the people we're talking about, is was one of the authors of the memo, is on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I don't know that he was on the now that I think of it, it was a full U.S. Court of Appeals decision. And did he recuse himself, or would there have been grounds to recuse himself? You know, I have not looked into that question. The caller has raised a good one, and I think I might make a call or two this afternoon to see if I can get an answer on that one.
All right. Line number two is next. This is all someone in Champaign. Line two, hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. My name is Francis Boyle. I'm a professor of law here at the University of Illinois College of Law. I teach international law, human rights, international criminal law. And last January, I filed a complaint with the International Criminal Court in The Hague against Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, Tenet, and Alberto Gonzalez, for their policies of torture, enforced disappearance of human beings, and extraordinary rendition, and figuring out that even though the U.S. is not a party to the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court, nevertheless, these crimes took place in ICC member states, and the court had jurisdiction. Now, I then went to the Institute for Public Accuracy, and they put out a press release that went out to thousands of news media sources here in the United States, including NBC. And in fact, NBC contacted me about this story. I answered their questions, and they refused to publish anything at all about it. Now, here is one person trying to hold these people accountable, and including you and Bybee are in this complaint. And yet the U.S. news media refused to publish the story, including NBC News. Now, the ICC prosecutor has told me my complaint is still under investigation. Why does the U.S. news media, including NBC News, still refuse to cover the story about someone trying to hold these officials accountable?
What are you suggesting, Professor?
I'm suggesting that effectively the U.S. news media colluded, the mainstream U.S. news media
right.
colluded with the Bush administration
okay.
On these policies.
Right. And do you think I personally colluded
I'm
with
not,
the Bush administration?
I'm calling you to find out why did your news organization contact me upon the receipt of the IPA
press release. I can't
speak
to that. I didn't work for
and
NBC
then,
at the time.
And then
look, let me just
–
I've heard you. Okay.
Story.
First of all, I can guarantee you that almost everything you know about the Bush administration's use of these kind of tactics comes from reporting by the U.S. news media, adversarial investigative reporting, and I can show you every single thing that you put in your complaint, I can guarantee you, has been amply reported by the news media and was probably uncovered by the reporters you are accusing of colluding with the Bush administration. So I really can't give much credit to what you're saying. I personally have worked on this issue for years. I can name you many mainstream journalists who have uncovered unbelievable amounts of information that have worked diligently hard and have done more to educate the American public about this than any college professors have done. That said, do we know the full story? No. Are we getting as much information as we should? Absolutely not. Who is responsible for that? Well, the Bush administration, which classified this to begin with, but let's look at the Obama administration that's now in office that has shut down any further airing of this issue, that has refused to disclose more documents, that has taken a very aggressive line, including repeating the Bush administration claims of state secrets in court cases that could have led to more airing of this issue. Is this a good thing? No. Does it mean we have more work to do? Yes. But making these kind of really outlandish claims that the news media in general is colluding with the U.S. government is really just nonsense. Next caller, please.
We're at our midpoint here. I want to reintroduce our guest, Michael Isikoff. He now works for NBC News. He is a national investigative correspondent for NBC and went to NBC this summer. Before that, he worked for a number of years for Newsweek magazine as an investigative correspondent, then before that worked for the Washington Post. And particularly while he was at Newsweek, he wrote a lot about the war on terror, the Abu Ghraib scandal, and a number of other subjects. And, of course, all of his time as a journalist, he's written about Washington politics. And he's going to be here on the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk. This is sponsored by the History Department, and that'll be on Wednesday, 8 o'clock in the evening, talking about Torture, a Global History. And this is part of a History Department series that they're calling Bodies and Evidence related to trends such as use of DNA, gene analysis, and torture. And this is free and open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend is welcome. All you have to do is stop by. And again, this is at the Levis Center on the U of I campus on Wednesday at 8 o'clock in the evening. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe just I ask you one other thing. President Obama did say at one point that he wanted to see the Guantanamo Bay closed. And now
he didn't say he wanted to see it closed.
Oh, he said he would. He said he would.
There was a directive. There was an executive order that said Guantanamo shall be closed by January 2010. Of course, it is very much open for business. I was there just a month or so ago, and we are no closer to having Guantanamo closed today than we were on the day Obama took office.
Well, and that was
in January 2009.
And it's we actually have a connection here in Illinois because we have a prison here that apparently now the administration just recently said that they would move some people from Guantanamo Bay to here.
They would like to do that. I don't think they are going to be able to do that because Congress has put very tight restrictions on moving any U.S. prisoners to any Guantanamo detainees into the United States.
Really? So I guess all I know is what Reuters tells me, and they say that the administration said it would, but then it is acknowledging that
has happened in the last couple hours that I'm not aware of, as far as I know, there's no imminent plans.
It does indeed mention that Congress enacted a law saying that you couldn't bring people from Guantanamo into the United States unless they were going to be put on trial.
As far as we know, there has been no, although Attorney General Holder did announce that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the 9/11 conspirators would be put on trial in civilian court, that has been that decision has been under review for most of this year, and so far as I know, there's no resolution of that review.
So you just again, you're saying as far as you know, as far as anybody knows.
I don't know if there's some new Reuters story. Reporting something. I'm not aware of any such anything imminent.
Yeah, and now for the foreseeable future, you think that the thinking is that the people there at Guantanamo, they're going to stay there and it's going to continue to be open?
There's no question that it's going to be open for quite some time. There's just, there's 170-odd detainees who are still there. There's no place to put them. A great substantial number of them. There's no place to put them. Congress has imposed these restrictions. About 40 to 50 are judged to be candidates for indefinite detention. There isn't enough evidence to try them, and the government's internal review deems them to continue to be dangerous. And so there's really no solution that the Obama administration is willing to consider other than to keep them under lock and key. And since Congress has put the restrictions on moving them to the United States, it looks like they're going to stay in Guantanamo.
Yeah, all right. We have another caller here. Let's go to Effingham, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Sounds like your guest is excitable. But what I wanted to ask was, have it been mentioned yet, and I saw this on Frontline, which is one of the few places to go, and it's phasing out, I think. But Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld all got granted immunity from any of their activities in the Iraq war. Do you know about that?
Immunity by whom?
By Congress.
You get granted immunity if there's some criminal investigation underway. I'm not aware of any criminal investigation.
I'm just a common, ordinary guy.
Yeah,
I read and I watch, but that it was on a Frontline program.
Yeah.
I think maybe in 2009 or late in 2008. But it's on.
I'm not sure of the context in which you're speaking, but I mean, like I said,
you don't know about.
There's no criminal investigation that I'm aware of, certainly in the United States, into the invasion of Iraq, and so therefore there's no immunity to grant.
Well, they didn't take a chance. I mean, I don't think Frontline can be guilty of manufacturing information. I mean,
I can't discuss what I didn't, we can't take this anymore.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you.
Okay.
All right. Well, again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I wonder if we could shift away from terrorism and Iraq, and I could take advantage of your being a watcher of American politics to talk a little bit about the election that we're approaching. A lot of people are predicting this will be very good for Republicans. And in fact, just yesterday, I believe that Newt Gingrich was saying that he thinks that it's possible that the Republicans might actually do better this time around than in 1994, which was the midterm 2 years into President Clinton's first term. And there was a big victory for the Republican Party. They became the majority party in the House for the first time since 1954. So I guess what I'm interested in whether you could reflect on it is whether where we are now, how it is or is not like 1994.
We are still almost 2 months away, not quite. It's a little less than 2 months at this point from Election Day, but a lot can change. I don't know. It's certainly some of the recent polls show that this is not a very favorable climate for Democrats at the moment, and that among likely voters, Republicans have a substantial 10-point edge. But that said, if you look at registered voters, it's much closer, and the Democrats are absolutely competitive. I think a lot of this is going to depend on what the economic outlook is looking like. I mean, I don't think there's going to be any dramatic changes, but then you get to state-by-state races. Look what's happening in Delaware right now, where it looks like a teabagger might be able to get the Republican nomination from a congressman, Mike Castle, who was viewed as the overwhelming favorite in November. But if the Tea Party candidate does get the nomination, Republican nomination, it would make the Democrats instantly competitive. So in that race, and may even be the favorites in that race, so that would be one seat that, you know, a lot of people thought was going to, this is Joe Biden's old seat, would go to into the Republican column, may not be. So I don't think we know for sure whether this is going to be a repeat of 1994 or not.
Well, of course, certainly you can look at all kinds of polls, and you can probably find a poll that'll tell you whatever it is you want to know. And of course, Republican pollster, Democratic pollsters, they're going to spin to what they think is their advantage. So I guess the moral is you got to really be careful about how it is you read polls. Do you think there's any similarity between the kind of conditions that now Barack Obama is facing and the sort of issues that Bill Clinton was facing at the same point?
Well, there are parallels. I mean, the one difference is Clinton was plagued, as I recall it, by a lot of investigations, and the Whitewater story had taken off. There was just a lot of elements of the White House travel office. There were a number of these small scandals, but which had begun to raise questions about his integrity and White House ethics, that I think was a part of the factor. You also had things like the Democrats had been in charge in Congress for decades at that point, you had Dan Rostenkowski, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, who was being criminally prosecuted. You had the House banking scandal. You had a lot of frustrations at the Democratic control of Congress over ethics that I think played into that, and ironically, which also played into the Republican loss of Congress in 2006, the Jack Abramoff scandal and all those. Now, we have some parallel today with Charles Rangel, most prominently, the chairman of the Ways and Means, the former chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, who has been caught up in his own ethical issues and has ethics charges pending against him by the House Ethics Committee. I don't know that it rises to that level, so I don't know if we have the sort of same ethical parallel. But look, I think the driving factor right now in this election is the economy and frustration over the slow recovery in the economy. I think that's overwhelmingly the number one factor.
Yeah, I think also something else that some people have pointed to is maybe the differences between John Boehner and Newt Gingrich. John Boehner is a Republican congressman from Ohio, and he's the current minority
right.
leader. But he's the guy that if they took over, chances are he would become the speaker.
Right.
He was also involved with Gingrich and some other people in putting together the contract with America. But I think there's some people that look at the two of them and say, you know, that somehow. I don't know how you want to describe it, if you want to talk about charisma or muscle or influence or whatever, but they say that simply, and in terms of also the administration wanting to paint Boehner as being a bad guy, then in whatever way that you want to talk about it, that John Boehner is not Newt Gingrich.
Right. He's not the same kind of polarizing figure. He's not the same kind of he's not given to the same sort of you know, at times outlandish comments that Gingrich is likely to make. So you know, Boehner is a much lower profile guy. He's getting more attention in recent days and weeks because of the prospect that he might become speaker. Not all the stories about him are especially flattering, but is he going to be driving for? Is his profile going to be something that the voters respond to in a big way? I doubt it. I just don't think he's well enough known.
Mm. We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. So we're talking with Michael Iskoff. He's a journalist who spent a lot of time covering Washington politics, also written about the war on terror. He worked for a number of years for Newsweek magazine just this summer, went to work for NBC News. He's now national investigative correspondent. He's also worked at the Washington Post. He'll be on campus this week on Wednesday for a talk sponsored by the History Department, Torture, A Global History. That's on Wednesday, the 15th, 8 in the evening at the Levis Center. Anybody who's interested should stop by. It's free and open to the public. Questions welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk at illinois.edu. I'm just curious, if you'll forgive a sort of a personal question, whether it was a difficult transition for you or what the transition has been like for you going from working for a big print organization to a big broadcast organization.
Well, it's an interesting transition because you have to think differently when you put together a TV story than when you put together a magazine or a newspaper story. But I'm enjoying it. I'm still learning. It's a process. I still write quite a bit. I write for the MSNBC.com website, so I'm it's what we call a multi-platform deal, I think, in the trade.
Yeah, we're thinking a lot about the multi-platforms. I'm not quite sure we understand what that means, but we talk about it. I also was just sort of curious about what you thought about the future of your old home was of Newsweek. And as we know, magazines like that have been struggling. But then, of course, all the traditional news media have been struggling. I think last time I checked that the magazine was still up for sale. What do you think is the future of
Newsweek? Oh, no, it's been sold.
Oh, it's been sold.
Sidney Harmon, a sort of wealthy former stereo magnate, Harmon Kardon. Stereo, has bought Newsweek for $1, and he's also inherited you know, millions of dollars in debts. He's still looking for a new editor, as far as I know. But Newsweek is still coming out, still publishing good and interesting stories. It's hard to know. It's hard to be overly optimistic about the future of the magazine at this point, given the very difficult economic climate it is for print media right now.
Yeah, I just do you think that you and I would actually see a day when something like the New York Times said, well, you know, we're not going to print the paper anymore, or Washington Post.
Yeah, I don't think we're at that point. I know that Mr. Sulzberger, the chairman of the New York Times board, did make a comment to that effect, although if you examined it closely, he was really just saying sometime.
Yeah, someday. Someday
future,
we're not going to.
Someday.
Gonna, yeah.
I mean, he didn't indicate that that day is in any way imminent. But again, you know, publications like that one and you know, do and others do produce perform an absolutely invaluable function in our democracy. And as I pointed out before, in my somewhat exercise response to the college professor's call, it is because of the news media and aggressive report, investigative reporting, that the public knows virtually anything about this issue that we started out talking about, torture. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the case with many issues. And, you know, I think that anybody who cares about our democracy has to hope that publications, print publications, continue to survive.
We have another caller here. Certainly others would be welcome to call in. Again, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And the caller here is in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Following up on what you were just commenting on, I'm curious to know what your thoughts and observations are about whether there is a change or an increase or decrease in institutional, whether it be media or other institutions of government, a change from the approach in the Nixon years, including the exposure of the bombings in Cambodia compared to the drone attacks being orchestrated under Bush and now Obama, and in general, a greater deference, both with respect to institutions that should provide checks and balances like Congress and the media, and whether you see a change in reporting in the major media outlets from more of a investigative style to a style which simply reports what other people are saying. In other words, more of a this is what this person said, this is what this person said, and kind of leave it unresolved.
No, I don't. I think the real change that's unfortunate is the fragmentation of the news media has produced this kind of echo chamber where people just go to the websites and cable channels that conform to their prejudices, and people therefore don't get information that contradicts their prejudices. They only get information that that strokes and reinforces their prejudices, and as a result, stories that that investigative stories that might challenge people in authority or challenge the premises of one side or the other don't get the kind of traction they should, because people are simply listening to or reading what they want to hear. And so the news media's role as the sort of independent arbiter has been undermined by the structural changes in the news media, and I think that's a very unfortunate thing.
Yeah. I won't belabor this, and I'll make it brief. But you know, if you remember during the Vietnam era and the secret bombings that were going on in Cambodia, there was a great uproar. It was reported extensively, but it went beyond simply telling people this is what's going on. There was calls for impeachment, talks of impeachment because it was an unlawful use of force, an unlawful war. I agree that we have seen news reports about the drone attacks and the bombings by Bush and now Obama, but it's a different tone and a different level of depth in the reporting between holding people accountable 30 years ago and taking that same degree of accountability now?
Well, the specific example that you cite, there's no political or public appetite to hold people accountable in this country at all. In fact, the overwhelming majority of the country, and certainly the Congress, doesn't have any problems with what's being done. And so as a result, I mean, who's going to hold anybody accountable when everybody agrees with what's being done? Not everybody, of course, but a substantial part of the American public and the American and certainly the Congress. I mean, the drone attacks that you cite are something that, you know, certainly began under Bush, but have been dramatically escalated under Obama and are going on, you know, virtually every week with no public outcry whatsoever. You know, to some extent, I mean, this remains a classified program, so we don't know as much as we should know about it, but we do know that we know enough so that if anybody was going to raise and had any problems with it, there would be grounds for congressional oversight. But I mean, people are totally fine with it. I mean, you know, as far as they see it, the public sees it, and Congress sees it. CIA is going after bad guys, terrorists in the outer regions of Pakistan that are threatening our country, and we need to pick off as many of them as we can. Now, do we know enough about how many civilian casualties, what the standards are for making these selections? Absolutely not. But this is a bipartisan military and intelligence operation that's supported by both parties. And as I said, there's no public outcry over it.
Why, just, you know, given the fact that there has been certainly adequate coverage about Iraq and Afghanistan, about how much it's cost, about how many people, how many soldiers have died, about long-term problems for people who have been seriously injured and survived, about our waste of money in those countries, our failure to rebuild the infrastructure, the fact that this commitment could go on who knows how long. Why do you think that that somehow that isn't something that has captured more attention, or that people aren't more the public seems just not very concerned about it?
Well, I that's a very good question. Certainly, the winding down, the president's withdrawal from Iraq of combat troops, we still have 50,000 troops who are going to remain behind, has diffused the Iraq war as an issue. Afghanistan is very much an issue. Certainly in Congress it's very much an issue, where Democrats have the Democratic caucus has serious problems with the Democratic administration's policy on this, and I think that the Obama administration is wrestling with it. But yes, I think Afghanistan is going to loom larger. I guess the only, the key difference is that, to date, the casualties in Afghanistan are far less than anything that we saw during the Vietnam War. I mean, we are approaching, something like maybe 1,300 killed in Afghanistan. We had, 58,000 Americans who were killed during the Vietnam War. So people don't, there's certainly no draft. So people don't see the blood that's being lost to American lives in this. And I think that's, probably the big difference.
And just we have a couple minutes here left, just to go back to something that the caller said about asking you whether you thought that perhaps the American news media, at least the mainstream media, was too deferential to government, didn't question government enough. That seems to me that kind of criticism is something that I feel I've been hearing ever since Ronald Reagan was elected, that people have been saying that now steadily over all this time, at least people on the left have been saying that. And I wonder where you think that comes from, whether you think that somehow people thought that before that time, and maybe it has something to do with Watergate, that it was some kind of golden age of the media questioning government.
Yeah. There's kind of a ping-pong aspect to this. When Democrats are in power, Republicans think the press is going easy on Democrats, and we've certainly, if you talk to the Republicans, and they'll tell you how deferential the press is to the Obama administration, and how he was anointed as the one, as the McCain camp used to call him, as this sort of saintly figure who was going to save America, and that's the way the news media covered him.
and then you listen to people on the left, and they'll tell you how under the George W. Bush, the press wasn't nearly as aggressive enough and bought into the Bush administration's distortions that led up to the Iraq War, and you know, can cite chapter and verse of New York Times stories by Judy Miller that Trump administration claims that turned out to be false about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction and other matters. So, like I said, the news media is never perfect. There are plenty of examples of where we don't do our job, but I think there's also plenty of examples, as I pointed out before, where we do, and that much of what the public knows about the problems on both mistakes and more on both sides comes from reporting by the news media.
Yeah. I'm sure that you're going to continue to work on the same kind of stories that you've been doing now. What now interests you most? What do you think are some of the most important or maybe most challenging
stories? Well, certainly the war in Afghanistan
right
now. I've done a lot of reporting on the corruption inside the Karzai government and how Karzai has refused and in some cases shut down investigations that implicated his corrupt ministers and what that says about U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. I think that's a big area of interest of mine. But there are plenty of others that will occupy my time and attention here at NBC.
Our guest in this hour, Michael Iskoff. He is a national investigative correspondent now for NBC News, was for a number of years an investigative correspondent at Newsweek. Before that, worked at the Washington Post. He'll be visiting the campus a little later on this week, on Wednesday, on the 15th, to give a talk, Torture, a Global History, sponsored by the U of I History Department, as part of a series they're doing called Bodies and Evidence, related to trends such as use of DNA, gene analysis, and torture. And this will be on Wednesday, 8 o'clock in the evening, at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus. It's free and open to the public. Anybody who was interested should feel welcome to stop in. And Mr. Iskoff, thanks very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.